The following podcast is brought to you by The Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Well, good evening, everyone. It's always so good to see faces on the screen here. Around here, it's quite windy, but the wind seems to be blowing the clouds away a little bit, and that gives me a chance to see the moon, which is almost a full moon. I think that tomorrow is actually it. And I think that's actually auspicious for this talk tonight, because even though it we're still a couple weeks away from the end of the month, this is the last Thursday that we're sitting together in November, and the last Thursday of the month is the month when we usually do Fusatsu. And I say auspicious because Fusatsu is traditionally performed on the full moon. So we're actually kind of getting to that tonight, and it's just a wonderful image for the ceremony of Fusatsu, which is a kind of renewal. So just like as the moon renews itself, going through its cycles, getting dark, getting full, we renew ourselves. And one of the ways we do that is through this ceremony. So we're not going to go through the whole ceremony. I'm going to give a talk on the precepts. So we're renewing our vows and renewing our commitment to a practice, really. So the precept that I want to talk about tonight is the sixth grave precept, which is not discussing the faults of others. Now, I have to say that, you know, when I first was exposed to the precepts, this one seemed pretty straightforward to me. You know, don't gossip, don't disrupt the harmony of the Sangha. And I'm not a huge gossiper, and so it seemed like relatively straightforward. And in fact, I even kind of wondered why it was included as a precept, because it seemed like there were sort of bigger fish to fry, you know, not stealing and not killing. And, you know, here's this one, it's like, well, just don't discuss faults. So I thought, well, you know, I don't have to think about this one too much. That's good. You know, I'll just kind of do it. But actually, you know, as time went on, I realized that this precept was a lot richer than I had originally thought. And I also realized that it was something that, in fact, I really did need to pay attention to, you know, and in a number of different ways. So that's what I want to talk about today. So I think first is, you know, the hard recognition that I do sometimes talk about other people, about their faults. You know, I wasn't always speaking kindly. And, you know, it doesn't make me happy to say that. And the fact is, you know, I think I probably most of the time do a pretty good job of not vocalizing those thoughts. But, you know, even if I'm not, it is going on in my mind, right? So there's a kind of lack of generosity in my heart, in my mind, that was there. And even though, you know, in the moment that this is going on, there can be a satisfaction from a certain kind of self-righteousness or, you know, ha, kind of feeling, you know, in the end, actually, it really doesn't feel good at all, or not for me. And then, you know, beyond even that, you know, what about, you know, the countless conversations I've had about the failures of some politician or leader somewhere? And I'm sure I'm not the only one in this group tonight, you know. And I think that one of the teachings of this precept is actually to challenge us to learn how to voice disagreement without it becoming about personal faults or failures. You know, in other words, how can we separate the person from the actions? So, for example, right, an obvious one, it can be very satisfying for me to rail against Trump, you know, and talk about his innumerable faults. But if I'm practicing with this precept, it actually forces me to see that the problems that are going on in our society today are actually much more complex and have much deeper roots than anything that Trump was personally responsible for, with all of his faults. And so, in fact, talking about Trump and his faults and failures is kind of an easy way out. It's not forcing us to confront what's really going on here. So one of the values of this precept for me is to help me see that by doing that kind of easy talking about a fault, I'm avoiding looking at what's really going on. So to dig into this a little deeper, I want to bring up the way the three kind of nuances we get on this from Bodhidharma, Dogen, and the Zen peacemakers. So Bodhidharma says, self-nature is subtle and mysterious. In the realm of the flawless Dharma, not expounding upon error is called the precept of not speaking of the faults of others. So another way of saying this is that everything is perfect, just as it is. There are no faults. And this has to mean that perfect includes everything. So if even the things that our discriminating mind called flaws, are, we call things flaws, but they're part of perfection. That means every time we make a judgment based on our ideals, that doesn't really have a basis in reality because it's excluding all those things that we label as flaws. For example, again, getting back to the world of politics, you know, we would have to call even the recent climate summit as flawless. But at the same time we do that, we have to be able to acknowledge that if something isn't done about the climate, we're going to have some tremendous suffering on this planet. So how can we speak about this without expounding upon error, as Bodhidharma says? And what that means is that expounding upon the failures of the climate summit may not actually be the most helpful action. So the truth of flawlessness requires us to discern appropriate action rather than taking the easy way out of just talking about the flaws and faults of things. And I think on a deeper level, it points out that we're just going to continue to suffer when we cling to our judgments, and that we need to find a way to recognize the flaws as perfection. And that's actually liberation. That's the perspective of the absolute. Now, Dogen says, in the Buddha Dharma, there is one path, one Dharma, one realization, one practice. Don't permit fault finding. Don't permit haphazard talk. So I think that Dogen's reminding us that as, you know, living, breathing human beings, we get to make a choice about how we act. And he's basically saying, well, you could indulge in fault finding or not. We can indulge in haphazard talk or not. And I think he's saying that when we're discussing others' faults, that itself is a haphazard activity. So the talk about faults doesn't point to any essential truth. In other words, it's not based on any inherent organization or principle of reality. And that's because in reality, we and the other and the fault are all one. We're not separate. Which would mean that when we don't allow ourselves to find fault and we don't separate, we won't create a self and other. He's telling us we need to speak, but he cautions us to be mindful about how we speak. And I think this gets to the kind of focus and attention that can come with practice. So we're not going to waste our energy and talk haphazardly. Now, Dogen is also saying, I think, that if others are not separate from the self, then that means the self is not separate from others. Therefore, when we're discussing the faults of others, that's not different from discussing the faults of the self. Another way of saying that is, when we disparage ourself, we're actually violating this precept. So I want to talk about that a little bit. So when I first started to practice, my practice was, you know, focusing on my breath and counting. And yet, well, I found that when I did this, I began to experience anxiety. Now, over time, I began to see that actually it wasn't the breathing causing anxiety, but rather that anxiety was sort of taking the opportunity to make itself known to me through this practice. And that was actually an important realization, and I think it's something, you know, I still work with, because if I had been asked at that time, I wouldn't have said that I thought that I experienced a lot of anxiety. But there it was coming up. And at first it was all sort of indistinguishable from the breath. But once I began to just allow the anxiety to be, then the breath got easier and zazen got easier. But while all of this was going on, this idea that I was somehow not successful with following my breath brought up other feelings in addition to the anxiety. So I felt inadequate. There must be something wrong with me. Frustrated. There was something I was trying to achieve or make happen the way I wanted, and I couldn't. And so I was spending zazen trying to, you know, get something that I couldn't. Or, on the other hand, I was spending zazen trying to avoid the whole thing because it wasn't pleasant. And actually, you know, I'm sure we've all found this by now, that ignoring it does not help. I was sort of resulted in checking out and sort of dissociating and not really being present. So in terms of looking at this whole dynamic, in terms of the precept, we could say that I saw this as a fault and a failure and discussed it a lot with myself, right? And this actually highlights one of the features of our mind that I think we all kind of wrestle with, or at least I do. And that is that we experience our mind as different parts. So we say, well, there's the I that's the witness, or the I that's counting my breath. And then there's this other I that is thinking or complaining or daydreaming or having all kinds of feelings. And this experience of division within ourselves is just one more manifestation of our experience of feeling separate from everything. And what we've done is we've created two where there's only one. And very often, I think I'm not happy with what my mind is doing. Right? So then I'm discussing that other mind's faults. And I think that because my mind is not making me happy, I must be doing something wrong, or it's doing something wrong. And this is just all more haphazard talk. Now, at the same time, when this problem with my breath was coming up for me very strongly, I also had a problem with one of the sutras. And so this was the Jewel Mirror Awareness, Song of the Jewel Mirror Awareness. So this is one of the services we practice when we're on session. And at that time, we chant a variety of services. And in fact, most of our chants are kind of this steady rhythm, you know, like this. And it speeds up gradually over the course of the chant. And this is a real exception. It's a quite long song, but it doesn't go like that at all. So I'm going to, in case you're not familiar with it, I'm going to just chant a couple of lines for you. It goes like this. The Dharma of thusness is intimately conveyed by Buddhas and ancestors. Now you have it. Keep it well. And it goes on like that, with this rising of the voice and the lowering of the voice. Now, my problem with this sutra was not the words. Actually, the words are amazing, you know. They're very evocative, they're complex imagery, they're very mysterious, it's hard to understand, they're very rich. So I always liked the words, but I did not like the process of chanting it. You know, you could say that I had an aversive reaction. And interestingly, to think about in the context of this talk, I think that for me, the rhythm of this sutra was very much like the rhythm of the breath. So we could say, you know, the higher notes are kind of an inhalation, and the lower notes are an exhalation. And over the course of the song, the length of the higher and the length of the lower, they expand and they broaden in a way that's very similar to the way our breath lengthens when we're deep in zazen. And so, in fact, it made sense that I had a problem with the song, because for me, the chanting was similar to the breath that I was struggling with. So now, just to be clear, I'm not saying that the song, you know, is like the breath. You know, I don't know that. But what I'm saying is that my body experienced those two similarly and sort of unsurprisingly had similar reaction to them. And, you know, the fact is that this trouble with my breath and this trouble with the chant was not resolved by analyzing the situation and discovering that the two were like each other and having an aha moment. Not that it's a mistake to, you know, think about things and to figure things out and see connections and delve into, you know, root causes. You know, that's helpful and it can be very revealing. But in my experience, the kinds of problems that I've encountered working with my body have not actually been relieved by thinking about them or analyzing them. So the song gets at some of the issues I've been talking about, and so I'm going to chant for you one small part of it. Outwardly still while inwardly moving, like a tethered colt, a trapped rat. The ancient saints pitied them and bestowed upon them the teaching. According to their delusions, they called black as white. When erroneous imaginations cease, the acquiescent mind realizes itself. So I want to break that down a little bit. Outwardly still while inwardly moving, like a tethered colt, a trapped rat. Does that sound like anyone you know? I could have to say that, you know, that's me, you know, very often during zazen. You know, it's an imagery of energy that's not able to be still, and it's not harnessed appropriately. So if we look at this precip, we could say it's energy that engages in haphazard talk. The ancient saints pitied them and bestowed upon them the teaching. So what appreciation for the teachings and for the Four Noble Truths of suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the path, these precepts. And part of our understanding of the origin of suffering is one of those causes is separation. It's realizing that one path, one realization, one practice, one dharma, we don't get that. according to their delusions, they called black as white. So I think of this as like the naming of faults. Once we start to label things, we create opposites. We create black and right, good and bad, right and wrong. But we're creating things that don't exist. And we think that there is a problem over there with that person or maybe that part of me. And we don't see that I am it. We don't see that it is what? When erroneous imaginations cease, the acquiescent mind realizes itself. And this is stopping the fault finding. When we can do this, we can see that the self and other are not separate. We can see that there is, in fact, no fault. We can realize that the Zazen mind and the monkey mind are not two. They're just two different manifestations of one vast mind. When we cease our erroneous imaginations and allow the reality of this mind to reveal itself, then we're led to the Zen peacemakers. So the Zen peacemakers say, unconditionally accepting what each moment has to offer, this is the precept of not talking about others' errors and faults. Not discussing the faults of others is the practice of allowing ourselves to experience what we don't like and what we don't approve of and what we don't agree with and what we may even find reprehensible. And we experience this fully with all the feelings that come up, whether it's anger or despair or frustration or anxiety. That's the great teaching of this precept, in my opinion. Not speaking about the fault, not trying to analyze the fault, not avoiding the fault, not trying to fix or solve the problem of the fault. The Zen peacemakers remind us that what relieves suffering is practice. And practice boils down to the unconditional acceptance of each moment. And this is so even when the practice is difficult and not fun. So I'm going to end this on a more lighthearted note. I'm going to share with you a poem by E.E. Cummings. A total stranger one black day knocked living the hell out of me, who found forgiveness hard because my as-it-happened self he was. But now that fiend and I are such immortal friends, the others each. Thank you.